This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Richard Ady. Welcome to The Money. You've probably caught some of the coverage of the extraordinary floods in the central west of New South Wales. There are places where it really does look like an inland sea. As I speak, one person's dead, another three are missing. Roads and crops have been destroyed and houses swept away. And this follows flooding in Victoria last month and events earlier this year in the Northern Rivers region of New South Wales and southeast Queensland. Andrew Hall's the Chief Executive of the Insurance Council of Australia. Andrew, is there any indication yet of what this latest emergency is going to cost?
The claims are still relatively low because I think people are still getting access back. We need to remember that this is almost a slow-moving inland tsunami that's engulfing whole communities and cutting off communities. And that's why I urge people, if you've got an insurance policy and you know your home may be impacted, make a phone call or get online and lodge your claim now so that your insurer knows that you've got a problem and so that you're in the system for when you're able to get back to your property.
I'm wondering if there's any way at the moment of putting it in perspective compared to the events earlier this year in southeast Queensland and the Northern Rivers of New South Wales.
It has a lot of similar characteristics. What we've seen is that a rainfall event on Sunday evening of around about 100 mils in the hills west of Orange and into the catchment of the Lachlan River and Wyangala Dam produced a massive amount of water because the river systems were already so full and the creeks were so full. So the water has had nowhere to go except across land. And we've seen villages like Yugara absolutely smashed, Molong, Canoundra's main street went under, which many locals don't remember the last time that happened. So these river systems are literally at capacity, particularly across New South Wales, which is why these one-off rain events are having such devastating impacts on communities and causing such asset destruction.
How does 2022 look in terms of total claims then?
Well, in terms of what we are tracking from all of these flood events, we're now over 250,000 claims from flood events across the east coast of Australia since February, March. The total insured losses are around $5.5 billion and climbing every day. So this has been a very large extreme weather event to navigate through, and it's still not over. It has knocked off a number of other big events in our past, the Sydney hailstorms, Cyclone Tracy and the like. This flood event of 2022 is easily Australia's most costliest natural disaster now on record.
You actually put together some policy proposals for building more resilience in Australia earlier this year. I think it was came out in February, so back before the first Lismore flood. What kind of engagement and response have you had from the new federal government?
There's been a distinct shift in, I think, the attitude towards calls for resilience and mitigation that's happened. I think really it started to shift after the bushfires of 2019, 2020. But the floods have really driven it home that we can't keep allowing, you know, developments or people to live in the wrong types of houses in the wrong locations, because the impact on communities is enormous, not just the financial cost to, you know, insurance or the public purse that picks up the non-insured, but just the cost more broadly to people's well-being. And I think we welcomed very much so the federal government's commitment to spend $200 million a year on resilience and mitigation. That's a step in the right direction. But as these events are unfolding, it's a drop in the ocean for what is going to be needed if some of these communities can be better prepared for natural disaster.
It's actually a different way of framing the issue, isn't it? Because we have tended, for the most part, through settler history in Australia, to kind of mop up afterwards. And what we have to do, if we're going to keep living in the places more or less where we live now, is work harder at preventing impacts.
Well, we need to live in the right type of houses in the right location, built to the right standards, and we need to accept that, because as our population grows, we face a wicked problem of where are we going to house people. Allowing developments on floodplains is simply a recipe for disaster, and it impacts directly Australians, generally their greatest financial asset, which is their home. And we have all of these policies, government policies, geared towards helping people to get into their first home, and then very much a focus on how you can build your asset and your wealth through your home. But it's no good if that home is somewhere that's going to be damaged or you can't afford insurance. The risks are very high. And I think as a country, we know where all these problems happen. We've got a century of data now. And I welcome things like the Hazard Insurance Partnership that the federal government has announced. I really welcome the work that's being done in Queensland and in New South Wales now. I think Victoria now, post this event of the last 4 weeks, will come to the table as well, and we can have real discussions with governments at the local, state and federal level around where the problems are and what we need to do to fix them.
Well, these will be hard conversations, because some of it may say, well, look, we actually have to move this town. Perhaps we have to move it up the hill or something like that.
Well, there's various solutions, and a lot of people will jump immediately to the most extreme, which is the buyback. Now, I think buybacks do have a role, but they're almost surgical in their application, because we know where the most vulnerable homes are that flood all the time. And often the people who live in those homes are those that can least afford to go through that experience. So I think buybacks do have a place. I think, but there is a range of other measures. There's mitigation that can be done, levee banks that can be built, better stormwater drainage, better management of the river systems. Indeed, when you look at cities like Sydney and Brisbane, how we manage the Warragamba and Wivenhoe dams, I think they've done a very good job of trying to manage Wyangala Dam out in Central West, but it literally was too full. And no matter what you do around dam management, they eventually overtop. So it's critical we get the balance right here on what are the measures that are needed. And I think as we rebuild towns like Yugara and Rochester and Central Victoria and those villages around Lismore, those homes need to be built back differently. They need to be built in a floodproof manner or on higher ground. They need to be built in a way that prevents this sort of destruction happening again.
Andrew, thank you very much for joining us today on The Money.
Thank you, Richard.
Andrew Halls from the Insurance Council of Australia. Tugboat is something that you probably almost never think about, but it's absolutely vital. As I speak, the country's largest operator of tugboats, the Danish firm Svitzer, which is in 17 ports, plans to lock out its workers indefinitely after 3 years of bargaining over a new enterprise agreement. If that goes ahead, what will it mean? Flavio Macau is an expert on supply chains and logistics at Edith Cowan University. Flavio, would this have an effect on Christmas?
Well, it will definitely affect our everyday lives in a few weeks' time, but it will not affect Christmas that much, because if you think about, shopping and the things that you will get in stores and even online, most products in your gift list for this Christmas, they are already in the stores or they are already in warehouses. They are not in containers coming to Australia. That door kind of closed by September, October. So it will affect Australia and its economy, but an impact on your Christmas list, not that big.
As I said, Flavio, this affects 17 ports. Some of them are really big ports. And I think in only two of them, is there an alternative operator? But I mean, we are including Port Botany, Port Melbourne.
Yeah, those are really, really big ports. We are talking in Port Melbourne about 3 million containers being moved and 2.6 million in Sydney. So together, they will be about two-thirds of all the containers movement in Australia. So it is a big disruption if it goes ahead. And I think that's one of the reasons why all parts are getting really attentive and doing their best in a way for it to not happen, because if you quit those operations, it will be a major disruption.
So if it did go ahead, and as we speak, we don't know, which industries would be really hit?
We can say that there is one industry that will not be hit, which is oil and gas, because Svitzer from the start said that lockout would not go into those operations. So that's in a way is a relief. And then it would hit manufactured products like cars, phone device, laptops, and even some medication, pharmaceuticals. So as I mentioned, it would affect our everyday life to an extent, and especially those manufactured products.
You and I have been talking on and off for really throughout the pandemic. And the pandemic's been disrupting supply chains for nearly 3 years now. To what extent are companies I suppose, better prepared and more resilient than they were?
Oh, I'd say they are a lot more resilient for two reasons. One, they now have risk in their everyday planning, something that was kind of neglected in the past. So now they have better plans, alternatives, how to mitigate in case something happens. And another very important thing is that they up their inventories. They have more stock than they had in the past, because they know that they cannot rely on just in time as they used to. So there's a lot of more of preparation. In some sectors, the discussion is quite the opposite in a way. It's about having too much inventory. So we are in a very different position than we were before the start of the pandemic.
Indeed. If it goes ahead, would there be longer term issues for the country?
Well, definitely it starts a discussion about how this whole situation should be managed. If it makes sense to have so much of the business focused in only one or only a few companies, and how you could open the business or open this tugboat operation to other competitors to make it a little bit less dangerous to have so much relying on such few people taking care of the business. So that's an important discussion, and also has to do about Australia's dependency of imports when you talk about parts, about manufacturers, about pharmaceuticals, to what extent we should have a little bit more being produced in Australia rather than coming from overseas.
Would there be any reputational effects, Flavio?
Oh, it would have to the company, most definitely, because Svitzer, it is a big and global company, but about 25% of their business happens in Australia. So if the government takes action, as an example, to, in a way, limit their operation here, they will lose a big chunk of their business. And it does affect other countries that rely heavily on them as well, because they will start to ask the same questions about to what extent we should diversify a little bit more. So it does have an impact to the company. And to Australia, again, the impact is about having a conversation on how those things are organized, how our supply chain and logistics, how attractive and efficient they are.
One thing that it is really underlined, I think, for all of us, is that tugboat operators represent a sort of choke point in the supply chain that most of us, I know you almost certainly have thought about it, Flavio, but most of us would never thought that this could be something which seems small, but in fact is absolutely vital all around the world.
Supply chains, I would say that, you know, it's about the detail. The devil lies in the detail. So what you have, because it's such a global business, you have, you know, a few companies that become bigger and bigger and bigger and more specialized and more efficient. And they end up dominating those parts that at the end of the day are essential. So yes, it is some food for thought about how we should go ahead with planning those supply chains, making them more resilient so that we don't have that many surprises happening every now and then in the future. Because we must say a lot has happened in the past 3 years. You talk about the Suez Canal, you're talking about the tugboats, you talk about floods and railroads. So there's a lot of work to do to make those supply chains more robust and resilient.
There is indeed. I'm sure we'll talk to you about it again, but thank you very much for joining us today on The Money.
Thank you so much for having me.
Associate Professor Flavio Macau from Edith Cowan University. I mentioned tugs as a choke point in the international supply chain, but choke points are more common than you think, something I only really got my head around after reading a new book, Choke Point Capitalism, by Cory Doctorow and Rebecca Giblin. Rebecca's at the Melbourne Law School, where she's the director of the Intellectual Property Research Institute. I spoke to her earlier.
So what we're talking about here are these hourglass-shaped markets where you've got customers at one end and sellers at the other, or audiences at one end and creators at the other. And in the middle, at that narrow point, you've got these predatory corporations squatting there, where they're mediating the access. And by being able to do that, they're taking much more than their fair share.
Right. So the only way an audience or a customer can access the product, whether it's a service or a good, is through this choke point, which is controlled by a small number of companies.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it's not that this is sort of happened accidentally. This is a deliberate strategy. It's taught in business schools now. You have Warren Buffett talking about, you know, sort of salivating over businesses that have what he calls wide sustainable moats. And what he means by that is that other companies can't come in and compete away those profits. Peter Thiel talks about, you know, very openly that competition is for losers. So that's the orthodoxy. You know, previously the understanding was that, you know, say what you like about capitalism, but competition was fundamental to it. But what we've seen is a shift away from competition and towards monopoly and monopsony. And that's what creates these choke points. And it is what leads to, you know, massive increases in corporate profits and massive decreases in labor share, the amount that workers are actually getting for the goods and services that they provide us with.
Right. We are talking about your book. So let's talk about Amazon, which you do pretty much start with. How are they doing this? Because they don't talk about choke point. They talk about a virtuous cycle.
They do. They talk about their flywheel. They love to talk about their flywheel, this self-described virtuous cycle. And the way it works is they say they've got this lower cost structure. So that leads to lower prices. So they've really emphasized efficiency. And who could complain about that? They say that once they've got those lower costs and those lower prices, that improves the customer experience, which drives more traffic, brings in more sellers, which then, again, increases selection, but also lowers the cost structure still. And so this cycle continues and everything is wonderful. But what's actually happening here is it's not virtuous, it's anti-competitive. What Amazon's always been trying to do is lock in its customers, lock in its users, and they've got all kinds of tools for doing that. And once they've got the customers locked in, that means the suppliers are locked in as well. Because if you're not selling on Amazon and an increasing number of consumer markets, you might as well not be selling at all. Then once they've got the users and the suppliers locked in, that helps them eliminate competition. And sometimes they do this very obviously. There was a company called diapers.com that was selling nappies, and Amazon didn't like that because it sold nappies. And they burnt, I think it was about $200 million in a month to blow that company out of the water. And that might sound like a lot of money in order to, you know, corner the market on nappies, but it's actually very cheap as a signal to everybody else not to get into their kill zone, because the consequences of trying to compete with it are going to be that you will be destroyed.
Yeah.
And then once you've got everybody locked in, once you've got the competition eliminated, that means, you know, there's even fewer opportunities for customers or suppliers to go anywhere else. And then you can force companies like Amazon, then force their workers and their suppliers to accept unfairly low prices. So it's Amazon's playbook. They made a diagram for it. In our book, we hired an illustrator to draw the alternative version, what we say is really going on. But this is a playbook that an increasing number of corporations are using, because this is how you get those massive profits and you're able to extract all of that value from the people who are actually doing the work.
That is interesting that it was sort of, you know, Amazon may have perfected it, but you see it everywhere. And once you're kind of working your way through the book, you kind of go, oh yeah, there too. But you took a decision to focus on the creative industries. Why did you do that?
Well, yeah, it is everywhere. And in fact, we got an email just a week or two ago from somebody who works in the global ornamental plant industry saying that they'd read it. And yes, this is exactly what's happening in ornamental plants. Thank you so much for raising attention for it. But the reason that we focused on creative industries is between us, Corey and I have spent, you know, 3 or 4 decades working for artist rights, working in the area of copyright, trying to draw attention to these issues. It's what we know best. But more importantly than that, the techniques that are used in the culture industries just make for a really, really interesting story and make it clearer to see what's going on. But also, creative workers are the canaries in the coal mine. What we're seeing happen to them is coming for the rest of us if we continue to allow corporate concentration to keep increasing. That is already putting downward pressure on wages in an increasing number of industries. And if we want to change that, we're going to have to do something about it. So we're using the creative industries to demonstrate what's going on. But the idea and the message by the end of the book is that we need a movement against this, where we take power back, that we are not just consumers, We're not mere ambulatory wallets. We are, you know, humans in a society, and we need to allocate things so that it's fairer for everybody.
Yes. But this idea of big corporations becoming large monopolies, I mean, antitrust law in America was supposed to stop that. And of course, you're really looking mostly at America in this book, although of course it occurs everywhere. But they were allowed to become that way because of something called consumer welfare. Can I get you to unpack that for us?
Yeah, that's right. We made the decision to focus quite a lot on the way that things work in the United States because, you know, this shift in antitrust and the consumer welfare policy is the number one factor that allowed these companies to grow so wildly out of control. And of course, with the advent of the internet and digital technologies, creative workers who are outside the US are still really forced to work with companies like YouTube and other Google properties and Facebook and Apple, these behemoths in the United States. And that's got follow-on consequences for everybody. So we do talk a lot about other places, particularly solutions that we might find from other places. But what's going on in the US is super important for everybody. It used to be, for a long time, monopolies were seen as a bad thing, right? You don't want anybody to have too much power, because then that's going to be misused and you are going to see flows of money away from labor and towards capital. But what we've seen in the last 40 years was a redefinition, a reinterpretation of the existing laws on the books to say, well, actually what Congress was worried about when they created that wasn't really monopoly per se, it was about consumer welfare. And there's more nuance to it than this, but ultimately the way it's largely been interpreted and the way the law's been enforced is, are these policies actually impacting consumer prices? You know, even if a corporation has a lot of power, maybe it's just using that to be more efficient, and that's actually better for consumers. And so there's been like a sort of a presumption that monopolies, you know, should be tolerated or, you know, even encouraged. And there's lots of ways in which they're encouraged. Now, one of the difficulties with this is that even if consumer prices don't rise, and I'm going to tell you, consumer prices do rise under monopoly. It's just that there's often plausible deniability because it can be tricky to show that the rise was due to the concentration rather than other external factors if you're a little bit clever about it. But what really does happen in under a consumer welfare standard is that we see a big increase in monopsony. And now this is an unfortunate word. So monopoly, we all know about that because a board game for it. It's where you've got a seller that's got a lot of power. So Amazon has a monopoly over consumers in lots of different consumer categories like books and like audiobooks. But it's also a very powerful buyer, which is where monopsony comes in. Amazon is very powerful in its relationships with publishers and authors, right? Because it is the buyer for those products. And monopsony power is really, really dangerous because it arises at far lower market concentrations than monopoly. And it mostly affects workers and suppliers. And so the problem with the consumer, one of the many problems with the consumer welfare standard, is that even if there's like a little bit of a sort of stage magic sleight of hand going on here, right? Because you're told to look over there, look how good those prices are. But what you're not noticing is that there's a hand in your pocket on the worker side because you are being squeezed. The power that those corporations have got when you're a worker means that they can squeeze you or you're supplying goods so that your margin's getting smaller and smaller. So the end result is actually the same, that you've got less capacity to buy the goods and services that you need, but it doesn't necessarily come out clearly in the prices that you're paying at the cash register.
Yeah, in fact, one of your examples of monopsony involves Amazon and another publisher, and at the stage where they were able to put the squeeze on this other publisher, they were responsible, 8% of their sales went through Amazon, but that was enough to get them to back down.
Enough.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like it would
That's
be,
right.
But it absolutely is. Let's in the first part of the book, you talk about books, you talk about Amazon, talk about how the news industry got broken, and streaming and music, and there's a lot of things in it. But I want to talk to the solution. I want to get to the solutions part in the second half when you talk about kind of dismantling or finding a way around these choke points. So transparency rights. You begin this chapter with a story about how difficult it is for writers to get information about their sales on Audible. Can we talk briefly about that?
Yeah, and I think maybe this is the most, I don't know how you found it, Richard, but maybe for me this was the most outrageous story in a whole book full of outrageous stories. This is a scandal called Audiblegate. Many people will know that Audible is an Amazon company, and it's by far the market leader for audiobooks in English language countries. Now, there's lots of independent writers who self-finance their own audiobooks, which can cost, you know, $10,000 or $20,000, get them onto the Audible platform. And they started noticing that something was going a bit weird with their sales, that they were selling a lot less than they were expecting to sell, given that the audiobook market was increasing. And one of the things that was actually going on here was that Amazon, which is notoriously secretive, it was not playing fair, right? Amazon, we talked about how Amazon likes to lock its customers in. One of the ways it does that with Audible is it really encourages people to have a monthly subscription. So you keep paying and you don't consider going to another competitor. And for those people who are ongoing subscribers, it offered an extraordinarily generous returns policy. So if you'd bought an audiobook, maybe you'd had it on your device for, you know, a year, you enjoyed it, right? You listened to the whole thing, but you could still return it for a full credit at any time that you wanted. No questions asked. That was the promise in the policy. And when that happened, Amazon didn't care, because all it was interested in was your monthly credit, right? And what it was doing was it was clawing back that sale price, that revenue from the author itself. But it wasn't telling the authors that it was doing this in any kind of transparent way. So you would, if you're one of these authors who were affected, and there were many, many, many tens of thousands of them, you would log in to have a look at your sales and you would see your net sales. You're like, okay, I sold 5 books today. But what you weren't seeing is that you sold 15 books today, but 10 books you'd sold previously had been returned and you'd had all of those royalties lost. The only reason that people were suspecting something was going on, they couldn't get answers, but then there was a data glitch. And so suddenly 3 weeks of returns data became public on those reporting sheets in a single day. And so the veil was lifted. Authors finally figured out like the extent of this and how much it was hurting their bottom line and how unreasonable and unfair the policy was, that there were a lot of readers as well who were not realizing that if they did this, which was kind of like using Audible as a library service, they would return the book and then buy another book. They weren't realizing that that was hurting their favorite authors. Once that did happen, that transparency that was forced by that data glitch, it allowed these authors to mobilize. It's much easier to fight an enemy when you know what it looks like. And, you know, while it's been a really hard fight and Amazon and Audible have resisted very strongly, they have managed to get some changes to some of the more egregious outrages here, more transparency on the reporting and so on. So transparency rights have a lot of really interesting potential. And we see that in Europe as well, the Digital Single Market Directive there in 2019, that requires member states to give artists and performers new rights to understand how their works are being used, what kind of revenue is coming in, and how their pay is calculated. So that's the kind of intervention that we would love to see happen in other countries like Australia as well.
Now, copyright, which is very much your area, again, what seems like a good idea for content creators has made things worse. So very briefly, why and what is the solution?
Well, think about it. If you send your kid to school with a tuck shop money, right, and bullies are shaking them down for it, you don't solve the problem by giving them more lunch money, right? But this is what we've been doing with copyright. We've been giving more and more and more copyright, but we have not been securing those copyrights to creators. In Australia, we've got no minimum baseline protections for creators at all that stop them from having to give away all of their copyright. And that's what happens. The more we give them, the more there is to take away. And so the solution needs to be, we're talking about copyright, we need to have rights that are inalienable. Rights, you know, for example, reversion rights in the event that a publisher is no longer exploiting your work, you should have the right to get that back. And another thing that we see in Europe, in the event that you're not being paid fairly for your work, right, you should have a right to fair and proportionate remuneration. So there's all kinds of things that we can do, but we need to be much more targeted about what we want with copyright. Copyright's not an end in and of itself. We award it because we want to recognize and reward creators for the stuff that they make. and because we want society to benefit from widespread access to knowledge and culture. So we need to think much more carefully about policies that achieve that, rather than saying more copyright is good and less copyright is bad. We need a targeted approach.
Yeah, and it needs government intervention, doesn't it? You already touched on the fact that in Europe, their approach to regulating digital will start to make a difference if it hasn't already. Mm-hmm. It's only natural for companies to want to expand and fortify their businesses. I mean, the kind of natural approach for companies, they would like to be the only company in the world that did this thing, and so we had to buy it. But what we need is for governments to intervene and to change laws and make laws.
Yeah, look, capitalism is inherently extractive. They're going to keep getting more power unless we do something about it, which is why we have competition law, why we have antitrust law. And I think that people are really starting to see the imbalance just can't be hidden anymore, and that it's not just happening to creative workers, that the existing interventions are really not working. But the hopeful story of this book is where we build out all of these solutions. We show all of the different ways that you can widen out these choke points and help creative people get more of a fair share. Right? It's got a lot of inspiration for all of us, I think.
But basically transparency, which you've already talked about, interoperability rights, job guarantees and a minimum wage for creative work. That's
definitely something to think about. Yeah. And collective action is so important. You know, we've had some amazing examples in this book. We worked closely with the Writers Guild of America. And when we were writing it, they were on strike against the Hollywood talent agencies because they'd created these choke points as well. And even though it was the golden age of television, these writers were seeing that their share and their working conditions were declining precipitously. And what they did is in a single week, 7,000 Hollywood writers fired their agents. Yeah. And they ground this strike out for 22 months, and they finally got all big four talent agencies to get rid of the enormous conflicts of interest that they'd accumulated over time and actually start representing these people in the way that they deserve. So there's really exciting potential there. Collective ownership as well is interesting. Putting time limits on copyright contracts so that you can get your rights back after a certain amount of time. Because at the moment, things like music, you've got the big three record labels control almost 70% of the global recorded music market, and they own the big three music publishers that control almost 60% of global song rights, and they use that power to shape things like streaming markets. There's lots of objections to how streaming works, but a big part of the problem is that they were designed by the majors for the majors.
Just briefly, Rebecca, what about consumers? Because you talked about music before, and there is weirdly some hope from music, because it turns out that the big movers don't have quite as much power as they used to, because people who like music that's more out of the mainstream are kind of ditching on those choke points. So if consumers move, there's hope for us all.
That's right. And we're definitely seeing that the share of the independents is increasing in a way that's quite remarkable given how strong these choke points by the major record labels have been. So that is encouraging. And I think consumers are becoming more aware of these issues as well. They want their favorite artists to be paid fairly, but we need to make it easier for them to actually be able to do that.
It's fascinating. It's a real down and up, because halfway through you're like, oh my God. And by the end you think, yes, there are things that can be done. Rebecca, it's been fascinating. Thank you very much for joining me today on The Money.
Thanks so much for inviting me.
Rebecca Giblin's the co-author of Choke Point Capitalism, How Big Tech and Big Content Captured Creative Labour Markets and How We'll Win Them Back. There's a huge amount in it, I have to say. That's it for now. Next time, is the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, any good? The Money's produced by Kate McDonald. I'm Richard Adie.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.